prophet Nathan came to rebuke David and also assure him of forgiveness. He also brings him a warning about the consequences of his sin. And here we see one of these consequences being worked out in the death of the child that was born, David and Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 12, reading from verse 15 and down to the end of the chapter. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 15. After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted and went into his house and spent the nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, "While the child was still living, we spoke to David, but he would not listen to us. How can we tell him the child is dead? He may do something desperate." David noticed that his servants were whispering among themselves, and he realized that the child was dead. "Is the child dead?" he asked. "Yes," they replied, "he is dead." Then David got up from the ground. After he had washed, put on lotions, and changed his clothes, he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request they served him food, and he ate. His servants asked him, "Why are you acting this way? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but now that the child is dead, you get up and eat." He answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me." Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he went to her and lay with her. She gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. The Lord loved him, and because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and captured the royal citadel. Joab then sent messengers to David saying, "I have fought against Rabbah and taken its water supply. Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise I shall take the city and it will be named after me." So David mustered the entire army and went to Rabbah and attacked and captured it. He took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was a talent of gold and was set with precious stones and was placed on David's head. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there and signed them to labor with saws, with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brickmaking. He did this to all the Ammonite towns. Then David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. And the reading there at the end of the chapter, please keep your Bibles open at this chapter, these verses. 2 Samuel chapter 12, from 15 to 31. There are three aspects of this account I want us to think about today: the severe loss, the submissive attitude, and the surpassing grace of God. Severe loss, submissive attitude, and the surpassing grace of God. The phrase "the surpassing grace of God" came to my mind when I thought of the words of Romans 5 and verse 20, where Paul, pondering the grand scale of the Lord's salvation and how the Lord sent his Son as a great answer to the mass of iniquity among mankind, and Paul is read to write in Romans 5, verse 12, "Where sin abounded, grace did much more abound." Where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. And that is true on the grand scale of human experience and human history, in the light of the Lord Jesus Christ and the salvation he brings to lost sinners. I think we also see something here of surpassing grace of God. against the background indeed of great, great sin, and also against the background of great, great sorrow and great, great loss. And I trust as we reflect on this passage, you'll be able to go away saying, yes, the sin was terrible, the sorrow was great, but the grace of God was surpassing. Let's look firstly then this morning from this passage at the severe loss that David experienced. Severe loss that David experienced. Verses 15 to 19. This of course follows on from the terrible sins that David had committed. You remember how in the previous chapter, and this had been brought home to him in this chapter earlier on by the prophet Nathan, how David had committed two gross sins. He had committed adultery with the wife of Uriah. And he had, albeit indirectly, but he had also committed the sin of murder, disposing of Uriah in order to cover up his sin. David had committed great, great sins. He had made a genuine confession of that sin when confronted with it by the prophet. And he had been assured that the Lord had put away his sin. How gracious that those words were spoken to him by Nathan, that his sin had been put away. And even though he deserved to die for his crimes, he would be spared. But also, as you'll have noticed in the opening verses of the chapter, the words of Nathan warned David that there would be consequences for his sin. Several consequences. And here we see one of these consequences occurring in the death of the son that was born to David and Bathsheba. He had been warned about this through the words of the prophet that this was going to happen. And now we see here the prophetic word being fulfilled. Soon the child becomes ill. And I want to draw your attention to some aspects of this severe loss. The first thing we have to acknowledge, and we mustn't pass over it or try to downplay it, is the reason for the child's illness and the reason for the child's death. It's spelled out very, very clearly for us in the passage. Look at the words of verse 15. After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. The Lord struck the child. The Lord struck or smote the child with what was a fatal illness. This was a fulfillment of the prophetic warning that there would be terrible consequences for David. And David was the one who deserved to die. But in the providence of God, it is the child who dies instead. We have to see here in these words an instance of the Lord's disciplinary and chastening love toward one of his servants. For this discipline is spoken about in the book of Hebrews. And we're told there that the Lord does chasten and discipline every son of his. Every son, that all of us must expect at times, as a result of our sins, to experience the chastening, disciplining hand of the Lord upon us. And such discipline is painful. Such discipline is painful. That's what the book of Hebrews tells us. It's painful at the time. Causes can cause great pain and great sorrow can be very hard to bear. But the book of Hebrews assures us that it is for our good, that we may share in God's holiness. And here, severe though the loss is, severe though the judgment is, as we'll see, it does bring David to rely upon the Lord and helps to restore his servant to a closer relationship with the Lord once again. Now we have to be very, very careful here. Very careful indeed. We must not assume whenever tragedy strikes in a family, whenever a child is taken ill or indeed dies, that that is directly the result of the Lord striking them as a consequence of our sin. That would be very wrong. That would be very cruel. Think, for example, of how the disciples were falling into that very mistake. They saw the man born blind. It's in the Gospel of John, verses 2 and 3. They saw the man born blind along the roadside, and they immediately jumped to the conclusion by saying to Jesus, Lord, was it this man or his parents sinned that this man was born blind? This is what they were beginning to assume. It must be as a result of either his own sin somehow or his parents' sin that he's been born blind, that he's been struck with blindness. But how did Jesus answer them? Very emphatically, this was not the reason. It was rather that the work of God might be seen in this man's life when Jesus so graciously and miraculously restored his eyesight. So we must be very, very, very careful here. We do not have supernatural insight. We cannot read the mind of God in every circumstance and situation. And it would be very, very wrong for us to jump to the conclusion when there is some tragedy in a family that it is a direct result of the Lord punishing someone for their sin. But it certainly was in this instance. It was in this instance. This was the disciplinary, chastening hand of the Lord upon King David to draw him closer to the Lord himself. Note the father who pleaded for the child. The Lord struck the child. See David's reaction. In this moment of terrible crisis in his family life, confronted with this imminent loss, what does David do? Well, I think here is a mark of David's godliness. Here is a mark of his godliness. He pleads for the life of the child. He intercedes in prayer. It's a very, very strong plea that David here makes, isn't it? Look at the lengths to which he goes to make his plea for the child's life. Verse 16. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted and went into his house and spent the nights lying on the ground. He spent these nights during this week lying on the ground, pleading with the Lord that he might be pleased to spare the child's life. Verse 17, he wasn't willing to eat. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. See here, David is a godly man, pleading for the Lord, spare the child. The Lord does not answer yes in this instance. But there are other instances in the Bible where a declared judgment of the Lord is, as it were, diverted as a result of intercessory prayer. Hezekiah was very ill, ill unto death, and he prayed, and he was healed. The Lord was going to judge Israel, and Moses interceded for the people of Israel, and they were spared the judgment. So it is always the right thing to do, to plead for the Lord's mercy and the Lord's grace. And we're in a situation of imminent crisis and loss. The father who pleaded for the child. We see something here of the tender, sensitive, fatherly heart of King David. Yes, he committed great, great sin, which must not be excused. We see here something of his godliness. Many a father in those days would have cared little for a child. Cared little. David cares. And he pleads for the life of the child. And I think we also see the extent of his agony in the reaction of the servants after the child has died. Do you see their reaction there? How do they feel? They're fearful to tell him the news. We're told they feared. Look at the passage again here. 18, on the seventh day the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead. You know, I'm sure you've been in the situation where you've heard the very worst of news and you're wondering how you're going to tell the person that affects most deeply. Maybe they haven't heard yet. How are you going to tell them? That's the situation the servants find themselves in here. They're fearful about how David may react. I want to notice the phrase that is used here in relation to their fears concerning David. How can we tell him, verse 18, the child is dead? The New International Version translates it, he may do something desperate. He may do something desperate. The older translation, the AV, renders this Hebrew expression, how will he then vex himself? He'd become more troubled, is how it translated really. The New King James Version, I think, translated well, the Hebrew here, he may do some harm. Literally, the Hebrew reads, he may do evil. How can we tell him that the child is dead? He has already been so troubled. He hasn't been eating. He's been lying on the floor. If we tell him now the news that the child is actually dead, he may do some harm. This could be interpreted to mean that they were fearful that David might lash out at them for bringing the bad news. But more likely in the context, they were afraid that David would do some harm to himself. That such was the extent and the degree of his agony over the illness and of the child and his fatherly and parental concern. They were afraid he might do something desperate. People have been known to do that in the midst of their distress. Let us never ever underestimate what it's like to lose a child. Let us never underestimate what it's like to lose a child. Maybe not people, many people know this, but my mother had a child who lived only to be one. He was born with a hole in the heart. He was sick all his days. Died about the age of one. For many, many years, I think, to the end of her life, my mother would often speak of that little child and how she missed him. Let us never, ever underestimate the sorrow the loss of a child brings to a mother, or indeed as here, to a father. Here's how one parent describes it. The experience of such grief is lifelong. It may soften over time, but there is always a gaping place in your heart and in your soul that yearns for that child. There is always a gaping place in your heart and in your soul that yearns for that child. Another mother writes, there are words like orphan, widow and widower in all languages, but there is no word in any language to describe a parent who loses a child. How does one describe the pain of ultimate bereavement? How does one describe the pain of ultimate bereavement? So you see here very, very clearly severe loss that David experienced. And it should be a reminder to us to pray for God's grace and upholding strength to any known to us who have experienced such a loss. Severe loss. And secondly, we see a submissive attitude on David's part. A submissive attitude. The servants were really worried about David. How is he going to be able to deal with this when we tell him the news? The child for whom he has been pleading in prayer. How is he going to react? Will he be able to cope? Well, the servants are actually very surprised by David's response. For instead of giving himself over to a time of mourning, which is what they expected him to do, David responds in a way that really surprises them. Let us notice three things about David's submissive response to this most severe of losses. First thing you see there is the worship that David engaged in. The worship that David engaged in. Look at verse 20. Then David got up from the ground. After he'd washed, put on lotions and changed his clothes, he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. The Hebrew actually says he prostrated himself. He threw himself down before the Lord in humble submission and worship. This is remarkably what Job was able to do by the grace of God. What devastating news he received about so much loss, so overwhelming a loss. And yet remarkably, in that opening chapter of Job, we find Job, instead of Job, then he fell down to the ground in worship. And he said, "The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Remarkable strength and grace given to Job in the midst of overwhelming loss. What remarkable grace and strength given to David here. He did not respond to the loss with anger or bitterness or utter despair. But he came, prostrate himself in worship before the Lord his God. And he says something else in explanation to the servants for his change in behavior, which shows that David was very conscious of the grace of God throughout this whole event. The grace that David had sought. He tells them about the grace that he had been seeking, that the Lord might have been gracious to him. Look at his words here in the passage, in verses 20 to 23. Verse 22, he answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live." While he'd been praying and pleading, he'd been focusing on the graciousness of God. And the Lord in his providence had said no on this occasion. Still David is surely filled with some sense, the Lord is gracious. I can come to him now and know his sustaining grace in the midst of this great, great loss. The grace that David sought. We find such grace being sought in many of the Psalms. Whenever the psalmists are being overwhelmed with grief and with trouble, we sang one there a while ago, Psalm 31 and verse 9. The psalmist says, "Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress." I'm in distress, be gracious to me. Or Psalm 25 and verse 16, the psalmist says, "Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted." He seems very isolated here. No human support or comfort. And he prays, "I'm lonely and afflicted. Turn to me, Lord, and be gracious to me." Even when there's no one else there to bring comfort to our hearts, we may seek a gracious God to sustain us. The worship that David engaged in, the grace that David had sought, and then thirdly, in his submissive attitude, the hope to which David clung. The hope to which David clung. The very famous words here found in David's response. Look at them again in verse 23. "But now that he is dead, why should I fast?" These are the famous words. "Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me." I have a question mark here, because there are two interpretations of these famous words. Words that have often been preached at a funeral service. Words that may be very meaningful to some of you here today. There are two interpretations. Many modern interpreters say that simply what David is saying here is being submissive in the face of death. And he's saying, "Why should I keep on praying? The child is gone and I cannot bring him back. And even more so, I am also going to die." That we have to submit in the face of death. We have no power over it. And this is David's submissive attitude. And that there's no more hope here than that. Quite a lot of modern commentators would say that that's all that this amounts to. But other commentators would say there's much more here. This is David again looking to the Lord, the gracious Lord. This is David who has a hope beyond the grave. And what he's actually saying is this: one day I expect to be reunited with my child in the life to come. David, after all, is the one who can write in Psalm 23 of such a hope for himself. What does he write at the end of Psalm 23? "And in God's house forevermore my dwelling place shall be. David had that awareness, that belief, and that hope in the life to come. And these words may well go beyond a mere submission to the reality of death, but an expression of hope. One day, he'll be reunited with the child whom he has lost. However we take these words, these verses 20 to 23 shows an amazingly submissive attitude that David was able to have by relying upon the grace and mercy of his God. It's easy for us to speak about this. If you and I were called to go through an experience such as this, may we be able to turn to and seek and rely upon and be sustained by the grace of God. Severe loss, a submissive attitude. And then thirdly, the surpassing grace of God. The surpassing grace of God. In two ways. God is very gracious to David in the aftermath of this severe loss. The Lord is very gracious to David. He didn't deserve really anything from God because of the terrible sin he had committed. And yet, amazingly, look at verses 24 onwards. Amazingly, we find the gracious gift of a child. The gracious gift of a child. And I want you to note, this child was not born to David and many of his other wives. He did have other wives. This child was born to Bathsheba, where David himself comforted her. And she is the one who bears this child. And this is no ordinary child. This is a child who's loved in a special way by the Lord. And graciously, here's God's grace at work. Nathan is sent again with another word, isn't he? Previously, Nathan had been sent with a word of rebuke that David needed to hear. Hard word. A word hard to hear. And now the Lord sends Nathan with this gracious word. Well, what is this word? Look at what he says. Look at what the prophet Nathan says. Verse 25. The Lord loved him, and because the Lord loved him, that's the child, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah. The name that David and Bathsheba gave to this new child was Solomon. That's the name by which we normally know him. That's the name by which he is best known in Scripture. But he is given here, by the grace of God, a second name that would have deep and rich meaning for both David and Bathsheba, the grieving parents. This child is going to be especially loved by the Lord. Do you not see here something indeed of the surpassing grace of God to these two who had committed adultery, who had been guilty of grave sin, and yet in the Lord's surpassing grace, he blesses them with another child, and a child whom they're told is beloved by the Lord, a child who inherit the throne of David, a child through whom the promises of God to David will be fulfilled, that his son will sit on his throne. The gracious gift of a child. And then there's a bit more, I think. I think there's another aspect of the Lord's surpassing grace here, David. The gracious gift of a victory, and even of another crown. Look at the concluding verse of the chapter. Some commentators say this is rather an anticlimax to the chapter, to the story, that we move from David's personal experiences of loss and of comfort to the battlefield. And some commentators say there's a bit of an anticlimax, or that this is just given to us to complete the account of David's battle against the Ammonites and to assure us that David had the triumph, the people of God had the triumph over the Ammonites. The battle against the Ammonites had begun or been recorded in the earlier chapters there. And now this is just bringing the story to completion. Well, it is doing that, but surely is there not something more here? Is there not something more here? How could David have felt in the aftermath of the Lord's word of rebuke? Here's how he could have felt. I have failed the Lord so, so badly. How can he ever use me again in his service? How can he ever use me again to bring victories for the people of God over enemies? Surely I'm finished as a useful servant of God. How could he use someone like me who let him down so, so badly, broke his law so grievously? How could he ever use me again in any useful way whatsoever? And yet, here at the end of this chapter, the message comes from Joab. Joab says to David, look, the battle is nearly won, but it's not fully won. The city is surrounded. Their water supply has been cut off, but the Edomites need to be fully defeated. They still pose a danger to the people of God. And David raises himself, and he goes out onto the battlefield. And the Lord grants him a victory. Not only that, he even grants him another crown. It's quite striking here, I think, the emphasis on the crown. It's a very big crown. It's a very heavy crown. Look at verse 30. He took the crown from the head of her king. Its weight was a talent of gold. That apparently is 75 pounds in weight, or if you're into kilograms, which I'm not, 34 kilograms in weight. 75 pounds. 34 kilograms of huge, massive, heavy crown. And this crown was placed on David's head. See, it could have been the case that the Lord could righteously have said, David, you're finished. Your sin may be put away, but as a king and as a warrior, you're finished. I can't use you again. Another must be raised up to fight the Lord's battles and won the Lord's victories. But it was not so. God, in his surpassing grace, is prepared to use even such a poor and weak instrument, such a fallen man, such a sinful man, prepared to use him again in his service to win victories for his people. And even rather than taking the crown from David, the crown of Israel, which the Lord in his providence could have done, rather even than doing that, he actually bestows upon David another crown. Are there not times when after some miserable failure on your part or my part, we have been tempted to reach the conclusion, how can I be of any use in the service of my God? Take heart, David. God could use such a weak instrument as David to achieve great victories for his people. So we see here three things. Severe loss. In the wise providence of an all-knowing God, none of us can be guaranteed immunity from the severity of loss in this world. The Lord does discipline those he loves. We see, secondly, the submissive attitude of David. May this enable you and I, hard though it is, to submit to God whenever things just seem not to make sense. And we've seen the surpassing grace of God, the God that you and I can look to every day, and even amidst the hardest things that the Lord brings into our lives in his all-wise providence. May the Lord encourage us and comfort us through his word.